bringing perspective and hope in spite of chronic conditions. It's the Chronic Life Podcast.
And now your host, Dr. Kevin Payne.
Welcome. And before we get started, let me reintroduce the podcast and myself. Half of all Americans, like me, and an appreciable portion of the world, now live with health conditions that persist for years. Many will never go away. Yet, we still need to live good lives, even with the added challenge and stress. Chronic Life Podcast brings you unfiltered conversations about those real challenges and real solutions. We talk with the diagnosed, loved ones, caregivers, medical and therapeutic professionals, and healthcare entrepreneurs who are on the front lines of making a difference. We also focus on the mental, emotional, behavioral, and social tactics for building meaningful lives. I'm Dr. Kevin Payne, host of the Chronic Life Podcast. I'm not a medical doctor. I'm a social and behavioral scientist, a research methodologist, and a data scientist. I spent 15 years as a professor and left the academy almost a decade ago for the life of a tech entrepreneur. In almost 30 years as a scientist, I've designed, managed, and consulted on more than 1,000 basic and applied research projects, including many epidemiological models. And that's relevant for what we're going to talk about today. Currently, besides hosting this podcast, I'm founder of a company called Chronic Cow. Yeah, you heard that right. We deliver science-backed, data-driven solutions that support you, your loved ones, and medical and therapeutic professionals toward quality lives with chronic illness. I'm chief data scientist for Sick Weather, an app that provides real-time, localized predictions for your health environment to millions of users worldwide. If you don't have it, go to the Google Play Store, the Apple App Store, and download our free application on your phone today. We're about to add COVID-19 tracking to the 27 conditions we already monitor. I'm the author of Your Life Lived Well, The Science of Crafting a Good Life Under Chronic Distress, Pain, and Illness, out later this year. I've lived with multiple sclerosis for at least 2 decades, and when I'm not working, I'm an avid skydiver, and you're likely to find me jumping out of perfectly good airplanes, although in reality, there are no perfectly good planes. Before we get started, here are a couple of show notes. We're coming back from hiatus, but this is so important that we've started our new season a couple of weeks early. So we're getting this episode out now. Over the next 2 weeks, each day, we'll re-release a remastered episode from last season, and we'll recommence with brand new episodes each and every week on March 31st. And I will also warn you that this first segment is going to be a little technical and dry. And that's because we're going to be talking about some of the numbers and some of the medical details. But bear with me, and we'll get back to making this relevant on a human level. That said, I have one final reminder. This is being recorded the morning of March 17th, 2020. What I will say is based on the currently available best information. A lot of what I have to say isn't going to change, but there's a lot we don't know, and our understanding is changing by the hour. So let's get started and dive into the topic that everyone's now talking about, COVID-19. COVID-19 is a coronavirus. Corona means crown or wreath, and that reflects how the virus looks under a microscope. There are many coronaviruses, but only 7 of them are known to infect humans. We're not certain yet, but our working theory now is that this one, like SARS and MERS, started in bats, jumped to another animal, perhaps scaly anteaters, and then to humans in the Wuhan province of China. So let's answer a few of the medical questions that you're likely to have. What are its symptoms? Most commonly, fever, dry cough, shortness of breath, thick sputum, also sometimes fatigue, shortness of breath, and aching body, but not runny nose or sneezing. It has a long incubation period. Symptoms take 2 to 14 days to appear, but it doesn't appear to be quite as contagious as the common flu. Another question people are asking, what is a pandemic? Because that's a big, scary word, and we throw it around a lot. So let me define a couple of things and maybe set your mind at ease a little bit. An outbreak is a cluster of cases localized in space or geography and time. So if you have a few cases that are popping up in one community, that's an outbreak. An epidemic is a regional occurrence of cases clearly above the expected rate. So when we have an epidemic, it means two things. One, we're having more cases than we expect, say, like with the seasonal flu. And it's also occurring over a wider area. A pandemic, then, is an epidemic that crosses international boundaries and affects many, many people. It doesn't mean the disease is more serious. It means it's just more widespread. So speaking of that, how serious is this COVID-19? Well, again, the data are still coming in fast and furious, and we're still trying to figure this out, but it looks like about 80% of those cases that are identified will need no treatment. So about half of them, or about 40% of the overall identified cases, will have mild symptoms. It'll be uncomfortable, and you won't like it. You may be a little grumpy, but you're going to be fine. Another half of those cases, so another 40% overall of those identified cases, will have what amounts to a mild pneumonia. Now, a mild pneumonia seems like an oxymoron here, but what it means is, technically, that you'll need no external respiratory support. So you may have shortness of breath, but you're not going to have to go into the hospital or be on a ventilator or anything like that. That leaves 20% of the cases that we identify. 16 to 19% of these cases will need serious medical intervention. So you'll probably need to be under some kind of supervised care in a hospital for a period of time, and you may need to be on a respirator or have other kinds of medical support. And then 1 to 4% will be fatal. Yeah, you can compare these statistics to other causes of death, like the flu. And for most people, the flu fatality rate is 1 or 2 in 10,000. For those over 65, it's about 8 in 1,000. And we lose tens of thousands of people every year to the flu. And because that is so common and so pervasive, we compare maybe the potential numbers from the coronavirus and say, well, this isn't so serious. But as we'll get into in a bit, that's not all of the consideration. Based on the data we have so far, for COVID-19, the fatality rate is about 2 in 1,000 for young people. And it rises steadily to somewhere in the range of 8 to 10% or more for the elderly. And when it kills slowly over days and weeks. That's why worldwide now, even though this has been going on for a few months, out of all of the identified cases, there's still over half of them that have not recovered yet. So we're still waiting to see what's going to happen there. But here's the real point about how serious it is. This is a novel coronavirus. Novel doesn't mean that it's flashy or interesting or anything like that. It means that it's new. And the consequences of it being new is that we don't know how bad it could get. We don't know how long we can wait to get it under control. And we don't have the procedures, systems, and treatments in place to handle it. And that makes it different from something like the flu, or even something like the measles or mumps that our healthcare system has dealt with before. The next question that people often ask is, how contagious is it? Well, us geeky math types call this R-naught. So it's written R0 and pronounced R-naught. And R-naught is the rate of contagion. So if the R-naught of a disease is 1, that means for every infected person, they're on average going to infect one other person during the period that they are contagious. The R-naught for this novel coronavirus appears to be somewhere in the range of 2 to slightly over 3. So that makes it a bit more contagious than the seasonal flu, Ebola, or the novovirus, but not nearly as contagious as something like measles or mumps. The next question people often ask is, how is it spread? So we're still working out all the details, but mainly through droplets expelled by coughing or sneezing. The standard line is that those droplets spread about 6 feet before settling onto surfaces where they can live outside the body for a short time. But there's reason to believe that they may travel further or last as long as hours on non-porous surfaces, so we might want to be more cautious. This is why we keep hearing the advice to repeatedly wash our hands and not touch our faces, where the relatively open surfaces of our mouth, nose, and eyes allow more easy entry into the body. Since it has a long incubation period, those with early infections still tend to be moving around in the world, not yet feeling symptoms, while carrying a high viral load. The upshot is that those who are apparently healthy can be unwitting active disease vectors. And that brings us to the question, where are we at now? Well, these things are hard to predict because they still carry so many unknowns. I was on a phone call with the CDC last week as part of a group of data scientists consulting on how to best model this beast so we can optimize provision of services. Everyone agreed that there's still so much we don't know. Our outcomes are still up in the air because they depend so much on what we do now. 2/3 of all our health outcomes are due to behavioral, social, and environmental factors. Our collective fate is in our individual hands, and what we each decide to do right now will make a difference for ourselves, our loved ones, and our communities. The best models for the American case right now are the Hubei province of China, where COVID-19 started, and Italy. That seems pretty grim, but our numbers are currently following a few weeks or days behind their trajectories. So, to give you an idea, the Hubei province has a population of about 59 million. Out of those 59 million people, there are, as of this day, 67,799 confirmed cases. A little over 3,000 of those have been fatal. And about 3,500 of them right now are still in serious medical condition. Almost 56,000 have now completely recovered. In Italy, right now, with a population of about 60.5 million people, there are 27,980 confirmed cases. A little over 2,000 of them, about 2,200, have been fatal. And there are 1,800 who are in serious condition. But there are only 2,700 who've recovered at this point. So we have tens of thousands of cases in Italy where they're still sick and still fighting through to see how their case is going to be resolved. In the United States, with almost 330 million people, we've got only 4,522 confirmed cases at this point. And the reason why is because we've been a bit slow getting testing out there. And So we only know of 4,500 cases. There have been 87 fatalities. 60 are currently in serious condition, and 8 of those known cases have now recovered. In the world, there are 186,000 cases and almost 7,500 fatalities. So if we project those figures out onto the United States, we're looking at somewhere between 150 and 380,000 confirmed cases. That means we're probably going to expect somewhere between 12,000 and 18,000 fatalities, and that about 30,000 cases will be really serious. But that may well be the best case scenario, because we don't know. Drawing on other models and how our testing rate is at this point, I would estimate that the ratio of confirmed cases to unidentified cases in the United States right now is somewhere on the order of 1 to 10 or 1 in 20. So that means that you take whatever number the official number is and multiply that by 10 or 20, and you probably have a better idea of the actual number of live cases that are currently running around in our population at this time. So what all this means is, if we want a better outcome, that all depends on what we do right now. And if you're listening to this podcast, you likely have a chronic illness, or you love someone who does. That means you are likely to be at a greater risk than the general population. And we're going to talk about what that means and some of the fears and the anxieties that can be associated with that when we come back from the break.
I'm Dr. Kevin Payne. Just jump with me into your life lived well. Half of us now live with chronic illness. Mine is multiple sclerosis. It's your life. Live it well. A chronic diagnosis doesn't mean goodbye to the good life you wanted. You don't have to feel overwhelmed or hopeless. I'll show you how to save yourself. Take your first step at justjump.life.
So this past Friday evening, I went to the airport to pick up a couple of friends who'd been wingsuit base jumping in the mountains north of Milan for a couple of weeks. Now, what you have to understand is, for some of us, the idea of wingsuit base jumping by itself is just not enough. You have to do it in an active plague zone. But they got there at the beginning of March, and they were planning on staying the whole month. And then in the middle of last week, the administration here in the United States gave some conflicting, ambiguous directives about what was going to happen with our borders. And like many Americans, they decided that it was best to just get back to the States as quickly as they possibly could. So they got here Friday night. And after all of the hullabaloo earlier in the week, the interesting thing was they came back through the airport and there was no screening, there was no testing, there was nothing. From Milan to the United States. Now, by Saturday, the story at airports around the country was entirely different. Incoming travelers were crammed closely together in lines for long hours as they waited for, and if you were in the studio with me, you could see my air quotes, screening. From a public health standpoint, this was far worse than the day before. Our fear response is triggered by the unknown, or by vague and conflicting information. American leadership has been slow to respond and has delivered conflicting messages. That's not an indictment against hundreds of thousands of government, private sector, and healthcare professionals who are working themselves to exhaustion to turn this tide. This is also not political. It's a statement of fact. COVID-19 is here. We cannot containment. We cannot contain it. The time for those measures had passed by the time we looked to implementing those sorts of things. The coronavirus will move through our population. The time to take those potential containment measures was a couple of months ago. Everything we do happens in an environment, not just a physical environment, but also a social and cultural environment. There's some things happening right now that make our environment fear-inducing. The first is cultural overwhelm and repetition. So what does that mean? That means when we hear the same dire, fear-inducing messages over and over and over again. On the one hand, those are necessary because humans don't tend to respond to rational arguments. If we responded to rational arguments, we would have taken this seriously 2 months ago, 3 months ago. But we didn't. Somebody has to run around and say that the sky is falling. And so what that means is we accuse them of overreacting. But the problem is, whenever they were reacting appropriately, no one paid attention. But now, once we're in an environment where we hear the same messages time and again, we do what's called reifying it. We make it real. And we add to that our natural human inclination is something called automatic vigilance. So what do I mean by automatic vigilance? That means that our attention perks up at the negative. This is why we like the salacious gossip. This is why the story, you know, it's true in the news business. If it bleeds, it leads. Because the negative things are the things that can threaten us. And those potential threats perk up the attention of our primal basal brain. It triggers our amygdala. Our fear response is really loud, and it's really insistent, and it drives us to do non-rational things. And why is that? That's because it short-circuits our central executive, our later-developed, more rational problem solver. Our primal fears can't see the big picture. I mean, literally, can't see the big picture. You can't reason with it because that part of the brain is incapable of processing the rational argument. It just isn't. The rational argument didn't exist when it was adapted. And so what we have to do is not ignore our fears, not suppress our fears. You've got to respect your fears. You've got to make your fears think that they're being attended to. Because, after all they're doing is trying to save you. And if you don't pay attention to them, then they'll just scream louder. We've got to quiet the voices of our fears because they shout. They shout in our heads, and if we don't quiet them, then we can't hear the softer voice of our more reasonable, rational, evidence-based decision maker. So we can't ignore our fears. We can't dismiss our fears. We can't run from our fears. We have to face them. We have to acknowledge them. We have to make them feel understood and acknowledged. And then we can make space in our own thought, in our own emotion, for trying to see the bigger picture. It can be really difficult, but for those of us who live with chronic illness, we know a lot about living with health-based fears. The anxieties of an uncertain potential future. And adding the coronavirus concerns on top of all that can make it seem overwhelming for us because we've already got a lot on our health agenda to begin with. But, you know, this is nevertheless a process. We've got to allow our emotions and the drives that are related to our emotions time to process, maybe without acting on them, so that we can let them quiet down and bring ourselves to a better place. And part of that is understanding that we do tend to have this automatic vigilance, and we do tend to pay more attention to the negatives than the positives, because the negatives were the things that would kill us. We do tend to pay attention to what's concrete more than what is a little more abstract and maybe a little more bigger picture. We do tend to pay more attention to stuff that we hear repetitively. So keep all this in mind and realize that we're not inherently rational. Humans are rationalizers. We'll make a decision based out of fear or emotion or desire, and then, and only then, will we engage our rational mind to come up with a justification for why we've done it. And all of those are important things to keep in mind when we're dealing with our decision-making in this healthcare crisis. We also have to understand that in this environment we're living in right now, there are a lot of myths and misinformation. Some public officials are still encouraging people to keep going out, even though in the last couple of days, more communities, like my own community of Kansas City, have really clamped down on public gatherings and the availability of public spaces like restaurants and bars and things like that. And all of those are good things. And our short-term inner cave child, you know, of which that fear response is part of it, is likely to petulantly stomp its foot and say, I want to go out and have fun with my friends. And yes, we all want to go out and have fun with our friends. But you know what? It's more important that we do these things now so that all of our friends are still here in a couple of 3 months to go have fun with. There are other myths and misinformation that are traveling around out there. Here's one that I've seen several times. You can't really hold your breath for 10 seconds and determine if you've got an early stage of COVID-19. My producer is looking at me with a quizzical look, and there's this story that's been circulating around that if you hold your breath for 10 seconds, very deeply, and if you find it difficult, especially if you feel a tension in the bottom of your lungs there, then that's an early indication that you're starting to develop fibroids from the... And no, this is not the case, okay? There are conspiracy theorists and other colorful whack jobs out there arguing that this is a man-made attack or a political ploy, and no, it is not. And then there's some other people with goodwill out there who are earnestly pushing the line that COVID-19 can be protected against or cured through vitamins, diet, magic fairy dust, or any of the usual list of nonsense that those of us with chronic illness always get pushed in our face. I don't know how many times people have told me that my MS just needed to sleep better or have the right vitamins or something like that, or a magic juice potion or something like that. And no, it doesn't work to cure your chronic illness, and it won't work to cure COVID-19. So keep an eye out for the myths and the misinformation. There's also a lot of fear, panic buying, and quack cures. And one of the highest profile cases of those quack cures, you know, there's some people that you would think society was done with, but Jim Baker comes back into the fore here again, you know, the disgraced televangelist from the 80s and 90s, And the state of Missouri right now is suing him because he's been trying to sell a quack cure for COVID-19. And I wish the state of Missouri luck. There are also fear-mongering social media messages. There's a popular one that's going around on social media and through text message right now that the president will invoke national quarantine through the Stafford Act within 48 to 72 hours.
Okay, so I'm interrupting because most of us, including myself, what is the Stafford Act?
Yeah, well, see, that's just the thing. This is one of those things that's perniciously convincing because it includes particulars like the term the Stafford Act or 48 to 72 hours. It's very precise about these things. Now, the Stafford Act is a real federal law, and what it does is it allows the president to declare states of emergency so that they have the ability to lend federal support to states and local disasters.
Is that what we would think of as martial law?
No, it's not even martial law. It's just being able to bring in like the National Guard and other stuff to help out with a local disaster.
So we don't have to freak out about people marching up and down our streets, making sure that we stay in our houses and stuff like that.
Okay. No. As a matter of fact,
but that's what some of the fearmongers out there want us to.
Yeah, exactly. Think. Exactly. And that's really, you know, the important point here that you get these seemingly precise details, and that sticks in our mind, and we think, oh, yeah, if they're providing precise details, then they've got to be right. Well, yeah, the Stafford Act is a real thing, but it doesn't allow federal quarantine. And in fact, most constitutional law scholars will say that presidents don't have that right. Now, governors have a lot of power in that sort of area over their states. But presidents don't tend to have that. My point here is, if it looks too good or too bad to be true, then triple check it. And we all know that that's something we should be doing anyway. But in times of distress and in times when we are fearful, it is even more important that we do this, even though we are less inclined to get that done. We also want to listen for common messages. So if you get reasonable messages from multiple credible sources, the chances are it's probably something that you can listen to. Like in the first segment, when I was going through, I know, a lot of admittedly boring facts and figures. Those are the same facts and figures and similar projections that you will find other experts giving in this circumstance. And you should feel comforted because you're getting similar messages. We may have differed a little bit in our details, but if they're like me, the first thing that they said was that there's a lot of uncertainty here, and this is our best guess based on the models we have available and the data we have available. So consider the actual sources. Not, at the risk of offending someone, I'm going to, and I don't care, because this is for your own good. Not your bias about the sources. So I don't have time to be gentle with you. If you have a bias against the quote-unquote mainstream media or science, get over it. That was a luxury that you could afford in times of health. But your life and the lives of people you care about now depend on it. So, after the break, we will talk about some solutions and expectations for going forward.
You're walking down the street and your smartphone chimes an alert. The 6 score is increasing. Several people on the next block have been tweeting or Facebooking about the flu, coronavirus, strep throat, or other ailments. For users of sickweather.com, those phone alerts merge healthcare technology and social media to allow health monitoring from the palm of your hands with the 6 score. Think of it like Doppler weather radar for illness. SickWeather tracks social media mentions of illnesses, such as someone saying, "I've been diagnosed with strep throat," or "I've been battling this nasty cough." We've turned your phone or device into a field detector for illness. Download the app for free at sickweather.com. That's sickweather.com.
And we're back. Like chronic illnesses, we don't have a medical cure for COVID-19. The solutions have to be behavioral and social, and they won't be as neat as we would wish. We would all love to be able to line up somewhere and get an injection or a shot or something like that, and then not have to worry about it and be able to go on with our normal lives the way they were just a few days ago. That's not going to happen. Wishing for that is not going to make it so. At some point, months or more likely a year or year and a half from now, we may have some vaccines that we'll be able to use to mitigate future outbreaks of this particular virus. But we don't have that now. And to paraphrase Donald Rumsfeld, we don't get to meet a historic national health emergency with the healthcare system we want. We've got to do it with the healthcare system we have. So, we don't like to admit that we're vulnerable, and we don't like to feel lonely. And a lot of the suggestions that we're seeing, and a lot of the things that we're being asked to do, trigger those responses. They make us feel more fearful. They make us feel more isolated. And those are challenges that we need to get through because based on everything we know right now, they're not just the best strategy we have, they're the only strategy we have. What is it that we need to do? Practice basic sanitation. This goes back to something my mother was fond of saying, you weren't raised in a barn. Sometimes we get a little sloppy about washing our hands or other sorts of things like that because most of the time there are no long-term bad consequences for being a little slovenly about the edges. Well, this time there are. And so you wash your hands frequently and thoroughly for at least 20 seconds, and you get all the bits in between and the crevices and around the nails and all of your fingers in the front and the back, and you do it. And what's the best thing to do it with? Soap and warm water. Good old soap. It's not really let us down in millennia. Use soap and warm water. You can use a hand sanitizer with 67 to 70% alcohol. That's okay, too. Don't try to make your own hand sanitizer. I've seen lots of these recipes out there, and just don't do it. There'll be hand sanitizer back in the stores here pretty quick, and there's still soap that you can get. So do it. Use it. Don't touch your face. And I'm saying this as I'm scratching my nose here in the studio. So, bad host. Bad host. But in all seriousness, don't touch your face. And the reason why is because your hands are grubby and they're touching stuff all the time. And they're where you pick up a lot of your errant viruses and bacteria and other little germy things that you can't see. And then you take that filthiest part of your body and you put it to the most vulnerable part of your body. And we have the mucous membranes and the openings around eyes and nose and mouth, and we touch them all the time. So don't do that. Don't take the dirtiest thing about you and place it around the most vulnerable thing about you. It's as simple as that. You're playing the statistical odds. And I desperately, desperately, desperately want to scratch my eye right now, but I'm not. So, cover your mouth or nose with a tissue or your elbow when coughing or sneezing. Why? Because when we cough or sneeze, we're expelling those particles. We're expelling those little viruses. And we don't want them 6 feet out in the world where they're easy for other people to come in contact with. We want them trapped in a tissue that we can throw away, or trapped, you know, if you don't have that, in the crook of your elbow, there in your sleeve, nice porous surface, you know, the cloth, so it'll absorb it, and yeah, you can go do your laundry then afterward. But the point is, you don't touch the inside of your elbow to your face or to other things to spread that around. And if you sneeze or cough into your hands, then what you've done is you've given these viruses a place that's going to touch lots of other places, and it's going to live there, and it's going to spend 2 or 3 or maybe 6 hours out in the world, still viable, and somebody else can come along. So you want to minimize that transition. These viruses can live for hours at least. There's some studies that are indicating maybe even 2 or 3 days on non-porous surfaces in the right environmental conditions. Point is, as I've said repeatedly, we don't know. But at least 2 or 3 hours. So clean your digital devices. If your phone is like mine, it's grody. Ugh. And I try not to think that, but yeah, sometimes, you know, you look at that and it's like, why am I sliding my finger over the screen and it's all bumpy?
Well, just for your edification and for your listeners out there, before you came in the studio today, your microphone was sanitized. The table that you have your stuff on has been sanitized. We wanted to make this, you are immune compromised, so we wanted to make sure that we took steps to protect you. Even though you wanted to come in the studio and record as opposed to doing it through digital technology. So just want you to know that.
And I appreciate that. Clean common surfaces around your home or in your workplace. Clean obsessively. Minimize touching public surfaces when you're out and about where any virus may persist.
I have to tell you a little story.
Uh-oh.
I know I'm interrupting.
That's all right. Go ahead.
But it has value.
It does.
I was leaving a local establishment after having canceled our local parade this last week. It was tragic.
Don't get us started on the loss of a perfectly fine SNCC Saturday parade.
I know. But I was leaving a venue and opened the door for this older woman and her husband who were coming in, and she had her sanitation wipe out. Mm-hmm. She says, "Oh, honey, don't touch the door. Use this." And I said, I've been opening and closing the door all day. And she said, "Oh, but don't do that. Use my wipe." And she literally put the wipe in my hand. And then I proceeded. I wiped down the door handle for her and for the people coming in after her. And then I admit, I did go to my car and I wiped down every surface in my car.
Well, there you go.
It took her being proactive, which other people would think might have been silly at that point because we hadn't made all the other cancellations and stuff. But at that point, my perspective changed. She was taking it seriously, so therefore, so should I.
Well, the upshot of all this is it's making us hyper-aware of a part of our environment that we always ignore because we can't see it. And yet, We're all surrounded by millions of little beasties, little creepies and crawlies, and some of them are not nice to us. And COVID-19 is, you know, number one on the list right now. So, yes, clean the surfaces, don't touch public surfaces. And then we come to the big one here, that you know, as people with chronic illnesses, sometimes we can already feel socially distant. Sometimes we can already feel that we don't have enough connection to the world. But social distancing is a really crucial part of this. And the reason why is if you're maintaining at least 6 feet between you and other people, then you are minimizing the possibility of viral spread. And that's just really crucial. And it's really crucial for us who already have a lot of health challenges on our plate, and we don't need to add another one. So even if you are showing minimal symptoms, stay home. And at this point, everybody should just kind of lay low and be scarce just for the next few weeks. And look at it this way. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. There will be so many people who will be so delighted to see you again whenever you reemerge. It'd be like the groundhog. Yeah, really. So keep low for a while. If you have even minimal symptoms, then really, really, really do stay home. Stay away from others with symptoms. Avoid public gatherings. And what do I mean by public gatherings? I mean, a couple of things. One, we want low numbers of people in a space at the same time. We want low traffic in a space. And we want low density of people within a space at a particular time. So that means, if you would, you know, in a bar, you might normally have people cheek to jowl up against one another. And I would argue that that might be a little sketchy just in any terms, but because, you know, the kind of people who hang out in those places. But right now, you want to be at least 6 feet apart, maybe even more. My producer's giving me a look.
If you only knew the number of times I've been out with clients at those venues, mm-hmm. and the capacity is really kind of bulging at what the max capacity for the space right. is. And I'm like, if there's a fire, we're going to die.
Oh, yeah.
And this is so much bigger than a potential fire because it's invisible.
Sure.
We don't know. There's no smell. There's no other way to use senses other than the fact that we're in close proximity to make a good decision or judgment call.
And that's a really good point. We don't have any of the commonly recognizable danger signals here. It's really hard for us to maintain that vigilance and to maintain that level of awareness when we don't have an obvious external trigger. But hey, you know, I understand totally what you're saying. I mean, skydiving, we'll cram 13 people into that little plane going up. And so
that's terrifying.
Yeah. Well, that's why we want to jump out. Cuz you're up there with all those people and it's, you know, tight. And when you go outside the door, it's really open and there's a lot of space. So just be low socially. Now, another point here also is that if even one person in your house is infected, everyone should self-quarantine.
So even if they haven't been confirmed, if they're just suspicious, even if it hasn't been a confirmed case, but it's a suspicion, mm-hmm. You're recommending that even collateral people around the person who is suspicious go ahead and self-quarantine.
Yes.
Because the risk is that great.
The risk is that great, and there's not the wide enough access to testing that we can be certain.
So last week, mm-hmm. A person who had been in a facility after a person who was a confirmed case, mm-hmm. Was told to go get tested. And so all of us that had been on the periphery of that person, the COVID-19 hotline said we were at so minuscule of a risk that we were okay. But you're saying on the side of caution.
Well, I'm saying err on the side of caution, but I'm also saying, is this a person you're sharing domestic space with?
No.
Okay. Then, yeah, it's different.
So if it's someone at work that may have been exposed.
Yeah. Not necessary.
But it's someone, if you're sharing an intimate space.
If it's someone that you are living with and you are sharing those intimate living spaces with, then yes. Because there's no way to live with somebody else and not have some kind of, you know, cross-contamination.
You'd have to be cleaning 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
Not even Felix Unger could do this. Yeah.
That says a lot.
That says a lot. And for listeners of a certain age, they will totally get that reference, and everybody else will say, huh?
They had a reboot of The Odd Couple in the last 2 years. On TV.
Yeah, but it wasn't that successful.
Well, maybe they should have.
I'm a fan of Neil Simon. I love his stuff. And then finally here, you know, only wear a face mask if you are sick. Because it's about keeping your germs in, not filtering other people's germs from you. Okay? Consult your doctor's office before you go in. Okay, so don't just show up. So unless you don't seek medical treatment without getting the go-ahead from them first. Call in, ask, because the system is swamped, and it's about to be a lot more swamped as we go through the next few weeks. Now, obviously, if you've got an emergent state, like if you're having respiratory distress, then get in there. You know, get into the emergency room as quickly as possible. But if you are not experiencing emergent symptoms, then call up first, tell them what's going on, get their okay, and then go in. So don't clog up the system unnecessarily. And that goes, you know, double for all of your other non-emergent medical needs. So right now, we need to, each and every one of us, be concerned with helping the system keep as much open bandwidth in the available healthcare as possible for the people who actually need it. So don't go to emergency rooms with non-emergent conditions. You know, put off other kinds of care that you can live with for the next few weeks or months. So, you know, help protect the system so that it is there for the people who absolutely need it.
That's one of the things that my personal primary care physician put out over the last 48 hours, several articles and scientific findings about what the bigger impact is. And then it's not about each individual, but it's about when it comes time and we need those ventilators and we need the beds. She put it out this morning. Would you rather be in the hospital or would you rather be in tents in the parking lot? Because that's what it could come down to if we don't get in front of this.
Right. Right. And that's exactly it. And all of this is about, I mean, yes, this, you know, all of these strategies probably will reduce the overall number of cases, but more importantly, they're going to do, you know, we've heard the nomenclature here in the past few days, flatten the curve. And all we're trying to do is change the shape of the distribution of cases over the next period of time. So, you know, this all of these strategies contribute to both those things. And if you have loved ones who are in one of the higher risk groups, if they're elderly, if they're immune compromised, if they have, heart conditions or kidney conditions or respiratory conditions or diabetes, then keep your distance. talk to them on the phone, text with them, do video chats, things like that. Keep your distance. Because you may be a carrier and not even know it at this point. If my surmise from the beginning of this show was right, that the undiagnosed cases are outnumbering the identified cases by 10 or 20 to 1, or maybe even more, then that's a real concern that we should all be carrying around with us. So, practice risk assessment. Be more aware. Monitor yourself. And then know the federal, state, county, local agencies, the nonprofits that are providing service and support in your area. Know who they are before you need them. Take a little bit of time to get on the internet and bookmark those providers so that you know who your go-to people are, not just for yourself, but for the people you care about as well. And then finally, check in on one another. Just because we have to practice social distancing physically doesn't mean that we have to become socially distant from the people that we care about. After this last break, we'll come back and wrap this up with a few final thoughts.
I'm Dr. Kevin Payne. Just jump with me into your life lived well. Half of us now live with chronic illness. Mine is multiple sclerosis. It's your life. Live it well. A chronic diagnosis doesn't mean goodbye to the good life you wanted. You don't have to feel overwhelmed or hopeless. I'll show you how to save yourself. Take your first step at justjump.life.
And we're back. So to wrap this up, let's just acknowledge up front here, let's face it, this is terrifying.
And yet, I'm going to interrupt one last time.
You are? Okay.
I came across this poem this morning, and I've seen it several times, and I'm not sure who wrote it. I can't find the one that has the citation of who wrote it, so I'm just going to put it out there, because I think it's so perfect for what you're talking about today.
Yeah.
When this is over, may we never again take for granted a handshake with a stranger, full shelves at the store, conversations with neighbors, a crowded theater, Friday night out, the taste of communion, a routine checkup, the school rush each morning, coffee with a friend, the stadium roaring, each deep breath, a boring Tuesday, life itself. When this ends, may we find that we have become more like the people we wanted to be, we were called to be, we hope to be, and may we stay that way, better for each other because of the worst.
See, that's very sweet, and it dovetails nicely with something I was going to say, and your taste in poetry is much more staid than mine. I tend towards sketchy limericks.
Well, that's because of the pirate in you.
Well, it is part of the... Don't take me, the poor maiden begged, to the pirate I patched and one-legged. I'm not going to finish that on air.
Yeah,
on
don't
air
do that.
Here. I'm not going to. But, you know, we do have to find humor and we have to find grace in the darkest of moments. And the first thing I want to remind people is that 2/3 of all health outcomes are behavioral, social, and environmental factors. Let that sink in for a minute. Most of what's going to happen here in the next few weeks and months is going to directly depend on what we do as individuals and as a society. And that is really crucial because we have to remember there is no cure, there's no vaccine, there won't be for quite some time. Everyone is at risk. I'll say that again, everyone is at risk. Even if you come from a group that only shoulders a small amount of that risk, like most healthy young people, you don't know how this will end. You could be that 1 in 1,000 unlucky case. And every single one of us loves people who are at great risk. In recent years, our shared civic identity has eroded. But a virus doesn't care whether we're blue or red. This is a time to come together in what we do for one another. But coming together doesn't mean we give up our critical minds or our compassionate voices. Scientifically informed information and collective service delivered with care will save us. This is a generational moment. It's a moment that will define us as individuals and as a society. Nothing draws people together like a common enemy. This enemy is so small, we can't even see it. But it is also so much bigger than the petty differences that have fractured us. It is time that we be mindful, humble, and compassionate. We'll all be stressed. We'll all be distressed past our limits. And we can still take a pause and be mindful, humble, and compassionate. Since we're going to be unmoored from our normal routines and cues, it's a good time to gently develop some better life habits we'll later be grateful for. It's a forced block of found time where each of us has the opportunity to take stock and really consider whether we are as we want to be in the world. This is an awful challenge, but it's also an opportunity, and we get to choose what we make of that. So remember that from where we are now, the best case scenario is that in 2 or 3 months, all the hipsters and naysayers who are too cool for school will be crowing, "See, that wasn't so bad after all. We totally overreacted." But now is that time to overreact just a bit. Just a bit. This is a novel virus. That means we don't yet know enough to know where the right amount of caution is. If we overreact, we'll never know how bad it could have gotten. If we underreact, we'll lose far more of the people we love than necessary. Each and every one of us gets to make this choice. And I know that those of you listening have a great deal of compassion born from the experience of your life with chronic illness. You have experience that most of the American population doesn't have. Be a beacon. So I'm going to close this special episode now, and I'm just going to ask you all to go ahead and subscribe to Chronic Life Podcast on your favorite podcast app. Follow at Chronic Life Pod on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. I hope you'll join me for the next Chronic Life Podcast. And in the meantime, this is Dr. Kevin Payne, urging you all to be safe. Be well, do well, and be good.